Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Millennial Dentist Podcast. Super excited tonight. We are recording live. Well, not live, technically. We're off the live. But we are recording live on a plane in a Southwest Airlines from Nashville to Raleigh. And I have two of my distinguished colleagues, Dr. Ford Gatkins. First time podcaster, right?
Absolutely.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
You're not a millennial, but we'll claim
didn't know I was going to be on the same flight as you, but turned out
that way.
What
a treat.
Yeah.
It is a treat. I'm glad we got to spend. And another buddy of mine, Dr. Will Jones.
Hello.
Doc, you've been on the podcast before.
No, I haven't, actually.
Have you never been on the podcast?
No,
that's crazy. Oh my gosh.
I haven't.
Well, this is just a treat for me to get to record with you guys.
Yeah, man. Let's get started.
Let's just jump right into it. We got 50 minutes, about a 50-minute flight. We'll have a good little recording here. So, okay. First off, what I'd like both of you to do, because I do think it gives a little value to listeners, just so they know where you're coming from. They know who I am. Well, tell me a little bit about your practices. We're going to cut to the chase. I don't need to know that much about you, but you're a dentist, and we dentists are not that much different. So, Ford, give me a little bit of lowdown on your career so far and where you're at now in your practice.
Sure. I graduated Tennessee in 2006. Did a AGD residency at UT in 2007. After that, I went over to East Tennessee and filled in for a doctor who had to have some surgery, ran his practice, got up to speed really quickly, running a three hygiene practice.
That's exhausting.
It was roller skates, man. And I had knee surgery in the middle of it too. I was out for about five days with knee surgery and then, trying to crank it back out. So, after that, I went back to Nashville, and I was working with another dentist at the time, and bought my existing practice in 2009. It's in a town that's about 25 miles just west of Nashville, Dixon. So it was pretty much a bread and butter practice when I bought it. Really worked over the years to add some additional services and some really make it my type of philosophy, where we're integrating technology to really have the best outcomes for our patients. And not technology just because I'm a technology nerd or geek, although, I find it great and cool and interesting, but really want it to help our patient outcomes and make things better that we do in our day-to-day dentistry. And so do some laser dentistry, do some implants, do some digital dentistry as well, and try to stay up on the latest trends, and really always looking to learn a better way to try to tackle a challenge in the office. So
perfect. Well, go ahead and you give a shoot, because I'm taking notes here on what I want to talk about.
Graduated UT Memphis in 2014, AGD in Alabama, focusing on surgeries and sedation. Bought dad's practice a few years ago, and now am 100% owner of a Nolensville Brentwood practice where my father's an associate 2 days a week, currently struggling with figuring out how we're going to and when to hire an associate that's separate from my dad, and having some staff turnovers, which is a good thing, but just trying to hire the right people. So a combination of trying to know when to shoot the gun of getting an associate and making sure we're hiring the right people, and certainly moving into a brand new office in about 10 months. That should be a lot of fun. It's going to be absolutely
I'm pretty
beautiful.
Jealous of that, by the way, of your new office.
Yeah, I'm going to show Ford here these pictures.
Okay, so here's what I want to start. One of the things y'all both said that was interesting to me is you both did AGDs. This is something that we talk a lot about, and we get a lot of questions about AGDs, GPRs, should we do them, should we not? I was a big, I guess because what I did was I came out, went into practice, and took CE. And, you know, and there's a lot of, there's multiple ways it's going to cat. One is you can do an AGD, one is you can do GPR, you can come out, you can take CE, you can have mentors. I'd like to hear.
I have a very easy answer for you for that, though. Is,
well, I haven't even finished the question, dadgummit.
I know what the, you, okay. I know the exactly what the question is. Okay. Is it worth it?
Okay. So Dr. Will Jones and Dr. Ford, was your experience worth it?
Okay. So this is going to be very, very doctor specific, though, because what makes you so good at what you do, and you know this because I've told you this multiple times, is your ability to implement what you learn. And most people can't do that. So when they go to a CE course, say Botox, which I took multiple years ago, it was very difficult for me to implement that into my practice. Not because of it being a difficult thing to do, sure, but just because I had so many things that weighed me down that I put as a precedent in front of it. You were so good at implementing your practice that for you, it was probably good that you didn't, so that you could go ahead and start doing the CE courses on the weekends and immediately implement it.
But did you learn implementation in your AGD?
No.
You
think that, no.
So was that, so what then, what was it that you gained? Like, because that's my whole point, right? Like, so you're like, but other people, let's be a little specific. Like, so you did a very surgical implant specific AGD, which I think is a great, the program you did, I think is phenomenal, by the way. But my question is, how much more did you gain by doing that than what you could have gained in a 3-week program that didn't take a whole year to do?
Because my point is that my personality taking a three-week program would not have allowed me to implement it the same way that you implement what you do. So for me, it gained me the confidence to take it back and say, no question, we need to implement this, because I know how beneficial it is to my patients, as opposed to something like sleep apnea. It's taken me a year and a half to do sleep apnea, because every time I'm in front of a patient, I'm just like, do I really have a firm grasp on this right now? And now I do. So now I can, but it's taken me 18 months.
So kind of part of that is, I guess, is knowing your personality and kind of what experience you feel like you want to have.
Absolutely.
Because I do see that. Because, like, you know, it's hard, because for some people, you know, I always joke, some people will come back and have a course and they can do something and immediately implement it. Some people, they'll do it and they know they need to have another course. Some people know that they do it and they need a lot more education. So a little bit of it is knowing kind of yourself from that standpoint. Ford, tell me about your AGD experience, because I know nothing about yours.
Yeah, so it was similar to what Will was talking about. It was to do a lot of surgery implants. When I went to Tennessee, I got involved with one of the directors of the program at that time when I was a first-year student, and really started gravitating towards implants. You know, when I had free time, I'd go assist him in surgeries. So at the same time, back in that time, Tennessee did not have digital dentistry. So I learned kind of the old school way, off of looking at pans and, you know, learning how to pour up models, make your own stent.
Did you ever do like the BBs, where you like have to put the little BBs
absolutely
in the x-rays?
Absolutely.
Wow. You, know, you take, are old, take, Ford. Take,
yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for the reminder. You know,
I heard about that.
But so, you know, you guys have appreciation for the ease of the process now. But
we are,
know,
spoiled
there,
in
there
that
is regard. There is something to be said for learning how to do it the old way. You know, I used to pour up and put a tooth in the missing space, make my own stent, put it in the mouth. You know, I mean, I learned that way, so I have appreciation for it. But again, what did I learn from doing it that way? You know, I got to place between 35 and 45 implants that year, which was a pretty good number. It was a lot more than I figured that I would be unable to do going out and getting a associateship. At the same time, the other benefit with my program was, at that time, Tennessee had paired up with Lutheran Medical Center out of New York. And so, you know, it was nice to, on Tuesdays, we had distance learning, 4 hours of lecture. And so I got to actually hear a lot of different professors from around the United States. And so, you know, sometimes if you go into a residency program that's in the same undergraduate dental school, you'll kind of get that same type of, you're getting the same type of lectures and the same type of philosophies that you've had. So that was beneficial for me to hear some people I'd never heard before, some different turns on some of the same types of dentistry that I'd learned with some different techniques. So that was beneficial. But, you know, just getting your speed up. And then, like I said, really after that, that gave me the confidence, I think, to really go out in private practice when I was filling in for a dentist and tackle some of those bigger types of cases that you wouldn't necessarily jump on right after dental school.
Not most people. And that's the whole point of this, right? Is that there are going to be some GPR programs that aren't good and some that are. But the point is that if you are very good at saying, it's fine, let's jump right in, let's do this, let's figure out the problems and what the issues later and just start it, that's your personality, then probably a GPR, I don't think that if you could go back, that you should do an AGD. But a lot of people should if you feel like you need to know everything up front and make the mistakes on the front end. Because, you know, an oral surgery resident with a lot of surgical expertise is basically what we did for 1 year, just times four, times six, and then implemented with anesthesia and certain being in the hospital rotations as well. So they just see and make a lot of mistakes in their programs, so they don't do it when they're outside.
Well, and that's probably the negative to way I did it to some degree was, you know, I look back on my career now and see implants 1 through 15 that I placed, 15 through 30, 30 through 45, and it's like, gosh, those implants, you know, yeah, and there were some that were good for the sake of they were lucky or whatever it was, but then there's some that's like, gosh, just poor planning.
Right.
Or
wish I put some Gym 21 on that thing.
Yeah. You know, it's very little that on there. But, you know, sometimes you just, the biggest thing I look back on so far where I wish I could do things differently is not that I clinically handed it wrong. It was that I didn't know what I didn't know. It was that I didn't know I was doing something that was going to impact it the way it did. I didn't know that this was going to, I didn't know that attached tissue was so important.
Right.
Or I didn't know that, like.
And you learn that, right? I mean, yeah, you just ended up making those mistakes on patients that you. Some of them might be cash paying.
The hard part too is now is we're in such a dichotomy where we have less and less. It's harder to come out and find a good associateship, and there are a lot more opportunities to buy a practice outright, I feel like. So it's hard to graduate and do that, but I think if you've had a little more experience to handle that, then you can come in and be a little more quick to be able to do that than just doing it right out of the gate, I guess.
So what about people like, what's that guy's name, Spodak in Florida? Is he in Florida?
Craig
Spodak.
He's a stud.
So how
you
did
think
he
Zoom recorders, by the way, or airplane? There's not an airplane mode here. You think we're kosher?
I have no idea. Is it going to hurt anything? No.
I'm not saying anything.
No, it doesn't hurt anything. You know how I know it doesn't hurt anything?
Why?
Because there's no way an airline pilot is going to let us do Scout's Honor with our cell phones and ruin
what, that like is a good question. Like, let's be real.
I promise I'm turning
let's
this
be real.
Off.
Come on. When was the last time you put your phone on airplane mode?
Right.
I'm bad about that. Long flight, it may drain my battery, so it might do it. Like right now.
That doesn't do anything more than that guy's iPad over there.
Okay, so I'm just making sure that we're not breaking any rules.
Well, I think we're in the clear.
Okay, good. All right, continue on.
Okay. So what about Craig Spodak? Someone like him. He's got how many associates? He makes like $6 million a year or something like that?
Yes.
And his office is actually the beginning of my rendering started with his office. So when you think about that, what did he do? Do you know him? Have you met him before?
I do know Craig. I know pretty well. You know what the thing? What he did?
Show four of these pictures here.
So Craig's dad was.
These are the renderings of my new office that'll be built in about 10 months.
I mean, look, I still stand by. I think that if you can find a good associateship, it's still the gold standard of what you could do postgraduate. I think that you learn clinical skills, you learn HR skills, you learn leadership skills. I think if you can find a good associateship, that still to me is the gold standard the way to do it. Now, if you can't find a good associateship, I think a good AGD, GPR, etc., is a great option. What I've kind of gathered from talking with people like yourselves is that not all AGDs are created equal. So that you can't just wing it. I mean, for instance, yours is a good example. It's very surgical and implant heavy. If you have no desire to do implants, going to your AGD would be somewhat a waste of time. Or if your goal is to place a bunch of implants and you go to an AGD where they place maybe four a year, then that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I am a proponent of trying to you know, at least think about from some degree what the goal is, trying to, you know, make a fit that applies with that better than any.
Yeah, and I mean, there's an AGD in Texas that is strictly an AGD that is extremely pros heavy. I mean, they do, you leave a one-year AGD and you've done like 12 full mouth rehabs, crown on every tooth. And so that's not, we didn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to Spear for that stuff. And we're, you know, doing full mouth, we're doing occlusion in February together. So
let me talk about that. Okay, so let's move on to the next topic. So you know, off air, if you will, earlier we were talking about insurance, and Ford, you were saying, you know, you've been talking to Gary Takish, who's a great resource and who's done a lot of cool things in dentistry. Both as a practice owner and as a consultant and whatnot. And one of the things you were telling me is that you're looking to make the move to, we didn't get too far into it because I wanted to record, but I don't know, you can go into it in more detail, but to start to either drop some insurances, go entirely fee for service, kind of fill us in on what you're thinking.
Sure. So when I bought the practice, you know, there were a certain number of PPO insurances that were in network. I didn't really rock the boat initially, just kind of got in and tried to, you know, make, I believe 7 or 8 at that time. So now we have 6 that we're in network with.
Ford, how many patients do you have?
About 1,200. So I'll be frank about why I went down this route. We tried to do some insurance negotiations with SmileSource last year. And because of our structure, we are not set up the same way that corporate DSOs are. And so every one of our practices are owned independently. So you have 650 different tax ID numbers. So that aspect of it was one of the major reasons why the insurance companies found it harder to try to put us as a group negotiate.
So you said this is a SmileSource?
Yeah, that was with the SmileSource.
Are you still with SmileSource?
Yeah, I am.
Uh-huh. Do you like it?
I love it.
Okay, let's go. We can't jump to a next topic, Will. We got to stay on task. And that's on the moderator.
But I'm okay.
I'm
trying to give a little backstory as to why I led to going down.
SmileSource into our discussion topics.
Become less insurance dependent. Because we tried to do that, and it's very, very hard realistically to get any real traction with that, to be honest. And you know,
you're exactly right.
When you're in a outlying area, when I say outlying area, I'm not in, you know, the heart of Nashville in the city. I'm in a more rural setting. And when you try to bring a lot of types of advanced dentistry techniques, if you're reliant on a lot of PPO, you know, it's, you know, when you're doing those types of dentistry, you know, sometimes you're not able to get probably the reimbursement that you should for it. So that's kind of what led me to realize that, you know, if that's not going to be the route to go, then, you know, need to become less insurance dependent. And so, you know, does that mean you go 100% fee for service? Maybe, but maybe not. You know, maybe there's if there's a large employer that you have a lot of patients under, you may elect to, you know, get down to 1 or 2 maybe that, you know, have the best reimbursement. But definitely I'm going to, this year is going to be an exciting year to become less insurance dependent. And Gary has a great, you know, way to do that. He's done that in thousands of offices over years and years and been successful at it. So
that's all. It's basically just an algorithm, right? You plug it in, you get the numbers and you say, this is the insurance I'm going to drop.
You want to look at the insurances that have the lowest numbers to start with. Also, you know, some of the insurances have various periods that you have to let them know that you're going to be dropping them. And so, you know, there's that plus the amount of new patients that you're generating from an insurance you have to have before you just go and, you know, drop the ball. You got to have enough patients to bring in to replace those with specific marketing, preferably, so that you can replace them with patients that want to be in your practice, that are seeking out services that you offer, not that are here because you are on this insurance network list.
So let's dig into this a little bit, because to me, this is a great conversation, I think. And frankly, selfishly, it's something that I want to do as well. You know, how do you, let's just okay. So let's lay out some things here. So you said you had about 1,200 active patients. Is that what I gathered?
Correct.
You're in six insurances.
Correct.
What percentage? And excuses here. It's going to get a little loud. We're taking off. It's all part of the experience. Hands up. You're in network with six insurances. How many of those 1,200 patients are in network with those six insurances?
Roughly about 75%.
Okay, so we got 25% of patients that are strictly already fee-for-service. So, and I'm assuming that the plan is to gradually drop insurances. You're not going to like just say PC a buy and drop all six insurances.
Correct. The we've got the numbers, and so we've got two that will work towards first. We've got some goals set strategically by dates throughout the year.
Okay.
So
my next question then is, the ultimate goal for you is to increase reimbursement from the stuff you're doing. Is that what I'm gathering?
Yes, and the second part of it is, you want patients in your practice that are seeking services that you provide. When you provide what I'll call above and beyond, dental
okay.
procedures.
Okay. Yep.
Besides the bread and butter.
Yep.
So there's people out there that want those types of procedures, and so that's the types of people that you want to.
I don't disagree
bring
with that.
Your practice.
I don't disagree with that. Yep.
That value the types of services that you provide at a higher level.
So here's my concern. My only negative to it, right?
Sure.
Because I am spot on with you in that I believe that. I want to practice where the patients are there because they want me to do the dentistry. They see value in me doing the dentistry, the type of dentistry we do, and so they're willing to pay a premium to do that. Having said that, what I have found is that some patients, the insurance may get them in the door, but that gives me the at-bat or the opportunity to do way more dentistry outside of the insurance envelope that they have. And so my concern with, say, dropping insurance is that I start to lose at-bats. Because the more at-bats that I lose, the less opportunities that I have to convince or move people from, treatment plan to doing treatment, to actually doing it. So that's my big fear. Because to me, it's a hard dichotomy of, yes, I don't want to, I'm annoyed by the fact that I'm reimbursed by these insurances at a below what I should be reimbursed at. But at the same time, I don't want to miss opportunities from a patient who would have come in and spent $20,000 on X treatment plan, but they didn't walk in the door because I wasn't in a network provider.
Here's another way that Gary has helped me look at it. And so let's say dental insurance Z that you're in network with. Let's say for nice round numbers that the patients that you have, there are 100 patients that are under that plan. Let's say that the reimbursement that you receive is, $100,000, okay? Just for numbers. Let's say that you have, the other thing that you want to look at is how many new patients a month are you getting off of that insurance plan? Let's say, all right, five new patients a month from Z. Well, basically, what he says is look at that. If you weren't accepting that PPO insurance, so you got $100,000 that you need to replace, basically, right? Let's say new patients a month, five. So if you can come up with a way and spend marketing dollars, so you're going to take that $100,000 out. Let's say you can come up and make that up with $10,000 of marketing, maybe. Let's say, but then you're going to get your full fee. So and you're going to bring in a patient for specific procedures that way. So. And that's the other way to look at it is really it's a marketing expense when you are agreeing to take X percentage, for your services under a PPO insurance compared to being, getting your full fee for that. So
one way to look at it is what you're kind of saying is at the end of the year, you could look at your adjustments, for example, and essentially you could, like for us, it's $500,000. And it's like, okay, well, in theory, we could take $500,000 of adjustments, and we could put that towards marketing, and what could we in turn do with our...
What could you do with half of that? I mean, think about it.
What type of
a marketing budget would that be?
It's
so
substantial.
When you look at it that way and kind of reverse it, like you said, it kind of, it's kind of like that wow factor. And I'm not saying it's right for every practice. You can be, I'm a T-Bone, I've listened, you have these conversations about what's right. So it's not right for every practice, but at the end of the day, if you want to be doing the type of dentistry, you know, that you're passionate about, on the patients that you want to do it on, that appreciate the value, I think you have to consider it. You know, like I said, I've been doing it, you know, over 9 years in my own practice, and it's just gotten to that point where, hey, I'm to that point where I'm making that decision because it's right for my situation.
And I want to do it too. And at some point, I think I'll do it. You know, and like I was telling you earlier, I think my big fear is I look, you know, if the economy was a stagnant situation, or we're just it is what it is right now, I probably wouldn't hesitate to do it. To some degree, my fear is, okay, well, what happens if I drop all my insurances or my big ones, and next thing you know, the economy tanks, and all of a sudden, now everything shifts to the dentistry that I'm, you know, quote, passionate about doing, is no longer necessarily. That becomes a what's the word I'm looking for not necessarily like not optional dentistry, but thank you, elective dentistry. Does it become an elective type of dentistry that no one is now doing? And I, you know,
because they're concerned about their discretionary income all of a sudden.
Exactly. And so, you know, so that's, I guess, the internal fear that I have that holds me back from doing it, which at some point I have to get over, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, here's the other thing that's been said to me, you know, worst case scenario, my understanding is that, you know, if you drop an insurance, I don't know that there's anything that's written in there that you can't go back to them if something happened.
Right.
You know, if
you're
the bottom falls out, right?
That's true.
You can always jump back in. You can always jump back in and go, all right, okay, I need to go back in to be safe.
That's a good point.
So
that's a good point.
I don't know that there's it is that fear factor. It's something new, you know, oh my goodness, are patients all going to run out the door at the same time? And that's why you have it strategically done and planned out. But
so here's the irony in all this. What's funny is that we talk about these numbers and the strategic part and the algorithms and all that, because ultimately that's what from a business standpoint should help a dentist make this decision on whether to do it or not do it. What's funny is what's ultimately holding our practice back from doing it is my dad. And my dad, not in a negative way, but in a dad doesn't want to lose some of the patients maybe that are on those networks, because you care about them, right? These are your people. You love them. And so you provided care for them for X amount of years. And my argument to him has always been, well, it kind of in reality shows this reciprocal relationship, right? Because in one respect, we see, well, how much do they really care about us? Because are they only here because they get sweet fees?
There's a much easier answer to that, though. It's just the patients that he likes out of that pool, then just discount them until they stay there. And then you still get the benefit.
You get to fire the rest of the patients. Well, yeah, maybe seriously. That's what we do. Maybe that's what we should do.
It's like, hey, I really like you. I've done your veneers, two sets of them, for the past 25 years. And so what we're going to do is just continue a discount with you because we dropped your insurance.
All right, let's move on. I like this. Okay, so, Will, you said something I thought was a good something to talk about. So let's jump over to you. You know, you've said you've had some issues with team turnover lately, and I'd like to hear your kind of experience about this when you bought your practice, because to me, turnover is somewhat unfortunately is going to be necessary and going to happen just because. But when you bought your practice, Will, you know, you had existing team doing existing things. Tell us a little bit about the process of which, you know, how many team members are original, how that's worked, how that's been, and do you feel, what have been the big factors that have caused turnover to happen or needed to happen?
Man, talk about anxiety inducing. Buying your father's practice where those people have been there for 30 years, 15 years, 20 years, and they're all complacent, and you take someone who graduated dental school in fall of 78, and he is very easily set in his ways. I mean, nothing has changed.
Well, and then the reality is even though it's your dad, it's not that uncommon of a situation,
no,
right?
It's really
not. Because most people are buying practices. And you know, it's interesting. If you look at that generation was a single doc, practiced by themselves, do it this way, have a tenured team. That's a very common thing. So I don't think that's an unusual situation for any graduate to walk into.
You're right. And so one of the things that I struggled with more in the past 4 years from buying the practice is trying to understand what type of boss I wanted to be. Because I have some friends who say, you know what, you're going to do things my way or the highway, and they have high staff turnover. And one person that I'm thinking about is having difficulty finding a hygienist because of they're not in a big city, but they very much have the personality that you're going to do it this way or I'm going to fire you. And then you have the opposite end of my friends where they say, you know what, my father's hygienist has been here for 20, 30 years. It doesn't matter that she's unwilling to learn anything new because
that she won't probe people.
Like she barely she drops a probe in. She didn't even put any pressure on it. And there's always twos.
Everyone's a profi.
Yeah. Like 1 millimeter of bleeding. Like, come on. So, you know, the problem is in that vein, trying to figure out what type of boss I wanted to be. And that was that kept me up at night trying to figure out, like, out of those two, being really stern or being really nice, was there a way to take the compliments of both and do them correctly yes, I do think that there's a way to do that. Be nice as much as you can, but still let them understand that, listen, guys, this is my money on the line. It's my debt. I've got to have it my way. I will absolutely listen to your problems and listen to your concerns and take them into consideration. But ultimately, I want you to understand that if you don't like it, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. And once I figured out doing it that way, I've lost I've either fired or lost, I think, 5 or 6 people in the last year and a half. And literally every single time someone leaves or gets fired, this little weight lifts off my shoulders. And it's just been amazing. And so we've had 3 new people in the past 3 months, and 2 of them were hygienists. And the people they replaced had been there for 15 years and one had been there for like 20 years. And they came in and they know how to numb. They know all about like Florida probes and all the cool stuff that they're trying to bring to our practice. And they're wonderful and they're fired up. And it's just like, man, it's just so funny that every time I sit down and talk to my dad about possibly letting someone go, he's always so reluctant because to him, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't.
Yeah.
And man, I cannot disagree more from my experiences in our office.
Do you think a lot of that is generational, or do you think a lot of that is complacency on their part?
Man, I don't know. I don't know. Because, you know, I've already only been a part of one practice, but I tell you, my dad got to the point with one of his assistants where my dad is the most laid back person ever. And he will never argue with anybody. And this assistant was so bad and so mean to him that he had anxiety coming to work. And if you knew my dad really well, you would know that that's like totally not him. He hated coming to work because of the assistant, and he would not fire her.
Isn't it crazy how we pay the bills, we own the practice, we pay the debt, but we will let people like that control the practice?
I mean, this person would have gotten fired from McDonald's. I'm telling you. And then finally, this person had to go on maternity leave, so he had no choice but to get somebody else. And then it was just like a light bulb. It's like, oh,
this is amazing.
And so when she came back to get her job back, he said, listen, I'm sorry, but I didn't realize how mean you'd been to me. And she was just shocked that he actually fired somebody.
Oh, my gosh. That's awesome.
So the overall point here is that in my practice, the staff turnover has ultimately led to my understanding of who I am or what type of boss I want to be. And every time someone leaves, I'm perhaps lucky in the sense that I'm finding a better people, and I'm so fired up for what's to come because of it.
When you had people leave, did your practice suffer?
Not in any way that I could see, truly. And some of these people have been there for 15 or 20 years. And to my knowledge, I don't even have any patients, more than a handful, that have really asked where they even went, because the people that said, oh, I want to be with this person, I'll say Zoe. I've never had an employee named Zoe, but you know, I Zoe only for assisting. Those patients who were Zoe only and Zoe's already left were now with someone else and have not said a word, and is just as cordial. So I've literally seen
funny though how we say that, we think that though, right? Like, we think that if we fire hygienist A, that we are going to lose 20% of the hygienist's patients.
Right. And of course, you very well may, but in my experience, it's yet to happen. And I've had 6 staff turnover. And man, I just love it. I'm so, you know, the first person you fire, I remember a year and a half ago, I was like in tears. I felt so bad. I just knew it was the best decision. Yeah. And now at the sixth one, I'm like, listen, I'm really sorry, but it's time for you to go.
Ford, tell us a little about your early owning experience with team members and.
Yeah, what about your worst mistake as an early owner?
That's another point of thing. That's a good point.
Yeah. So when I came in again, I tried not to rock the boat a whole lot. Just tried to get in, meet people. After about 6 months, I did an upgrade on the practice. You know, started going digital and paperless and all that stuff. So that was a big thing at that time, right? Back in 2010. So that, you know, that set us on our way on the path to my practice mission and philosophy, which was using technology to create smiles and help people, right? So, you know, what you find out is that everybody's not always on, everybody doesn't have the same vision. And sometimes when you step into a situation where things have been accepted and been allowed to happen over a long period of time, it kind of becomes the status quo and it becomes okay. And you can still be successful and you can still be a great dentist and you can still help people that way. But when you come in and if you have, you know, certain values and once you get clear on what you want to do and how, like you said, what type of boss you want to be. But I think it really goes back to like, there's some things that are negotiable and some things that aren't, right? As we all find out as practice owners and everything. And so once you know that, you know, if there's somebody who's doing something that's really one of those things that's going to keep you up at night, make you have anxiety to come into work. I mean, what kind of life is that to go through what we go through and to try to help the patients and help, you know, employees and their families and do what we do. If you're miserable, you know, if you're having, you know, angst about coming in to your job. And so,
and the craziest thing is that we're the boss and we're still letting it happen.
So, you know,
would y'all like a drink coupon?
Say what?
Would y'all like a drink coupon?
Yeah, Jack and Diet. You can just tear that off. Hand it right to her.
Drink coupon sponsored by Sullivan Little Partners A-List. All right, keep going. Excellent. Sorry, I interrupted.
So has your practice philosophy changed in the last 10 years?
It's evolved, I'd say. You know, refined, evolved. I mean, I've always been very passionate about using technology to have the best outcomes for my patients. And again, when you go into a practice that's paper, no digital, I mean, you have to update all that stuff. I mean, you guys don't even know about that because you guys went to school and that's how you learned.
Well, I had to transfer my dad's too. Okay. So yeah, well, God, so awful.
You know, it's a challenge.
And was your dad?
No, dad was digital.
Yeah. So. When people have learned,
I had to teach my dad what a consent form was.
When the employees have, seriously. When employees have been doing that for a while, it brings about some uncomfortable change to them, right? They're comfortable. They've been doing it. Patients love them, right? What's the problem? Well, we're going to do it a different way. We're going to, because this is going to allow us to do better dentistry, to diagnose better, to treatment plan better, right? And so, again, you know, everybody's not on that philosophy and some people just can't break that old habit. And so then as I evolved, that became some of those conversations that you'd have to have, with somebody and maybe you're not the right, you know, person for this vision that we've got going on here. Fortunately, I didn't have to do that a whole lot. I really was able to add as we grew over the years. Added, you know, up to seven employees.
What'd you start with?
There were four, but one was part time.
Are they all still there? All the original ones still there?
No.
Any of the original ones still there?
None of the originals when I actually bought it, but I've got one that was there like the year after I bought it. So started part-time and she's
but you hired her.
Correct. So, you know, I mean, it's really, I think you just have to become clear on what your goals are, what type of dentistry you want to do, and then share that vision and that passion. And they have to be on board with it, right? And everybody's not going to be on board. And if you find that, that's when those hard conversations have to happen. Hey, Susie, I need you to. This is something that's concerning me. Let's talk about this. This is the type of way that we want to handle this, and this is the reason why. Not just saying, hey, do this because I told you so. I'm not that type of a person. I want to try to explain why, so they see the value in something that I believe in, right? And if they know I believe in it with my heart and that it's the best thing for our practice and our patients, then I think that gives them a little more a reason to be behind you.
You're a more efficient leader when
you
do that.
He's a way better leader than me. I was thinking the same thing.
Using fear.
So,
do this or I'll fire you.
I mean, I've made those mistakes, you know, and it's just you live and you learn with those things. But it's constantly, being a good leader, it's constantly something that you had to work at every single year, every single month. You know, you got to surround yourself with people that are mentors, that are older than you, that have been there and done that. That have learned, that can tell you, hey, man, I tried this one time. This wasn't the best way that I could have handled the situation. It's all about trial and error. And as long as you have a real learning attitude, then you're going to make the right decisions the most of the time. You know, I think so, with the right attitude and the right right heart behind it. So,
and one thing you said there that I thought was really important to point out and kind of magnify is, you know, the importance of being setting expectations for your team and giving them clear direction. Because I would argue that our team members want to be led, that they want strong leadership. They don't want a dictator, but they want strong leadership. And I think that sometimes that the worst thing that we do is we don't provide clarity for them. And we don't provide an expectation that is kept accountable.
I would say probably halfway through my practice over there, I got really, really busy. And so that feedback and that direct conversation with really what the expectations are and why those expectations are the way they are, it dropped off because I just got really busy.
Yeah, because you're busy.
I got busy.
Exactly.
So I was focusing on dentistry, on learning. I wasn't focusing on my leadership skills. And really, at the end of the day, you can be in our profession, in dentistry or any other profession, you know, the long-term success that you're going to have really is going to boil down to what type of leadership skills that you have, I believe, because you're only as good as you are, right? And your team really makes you be the best. And so in order to get those team members that are going to help you to be able to succeed, to reach your goals, your practice goals, your professional goals, and to make them the best, it's really, really important that you can try to really place value into them and let them understand, the importance of leadership. And you'll find that some of the team members they'll have some leadership skills too. Those are the ones you may want to pour into more, you know, have a hygiene coordinator, you know, or a lead hygiene person or a lead assistant, you know, and when you do that,
do you have lead assistants, lead hygienists?
Yes and no.
Do you have, Tebow calls them champions. Do you have like champions in your office that like kind of own procedures or own, you know, that's a big thing that I've been trying to figure out lately. Cause like, I'm so sick and tired of going in and they're not being daggum gloves in the drawer. And I look up and they're all like, you know, they're looking behind them like someone else should have taken care of it. I'm like, can we have some freaking accountability here? Yeah. Like maybe it's your job that this operatory is yours to keep stocked, or maybe it's your operatory that implant parts are already here and, or whatever it is. And so I'm really considering moving towards just defining roles even more, because I feel like the whole we're all in charge gets nothing done.
I think there's a lot of value in that. I think if you can have somebody, you know, with implants, if you can have somebody who's in charge of all the implant ordering, implant stock, keeping up with that stuff, it's better than just saying, okay, you all do it, and then somebody drops the ball and it's like, okay, well, what happened here? I didn't. It wasn't me. It wasn't you.
Clear direction.
Who knows?
What you're talking about.
And but again, you know, the people who have leadership qualities, they will gravitate towards that if you let that be known. Like, hey, I need somebody who can step up and who can be a leader. You know, myself, I work best when I can have somebody in the back saying, hey, you need to go do this check, that check before you sit down for this surgery.
Yeah.
Because I get
even
so
even you
want focused.
To be to some degree led
I
like that.
I want somebody
yeah.
to help direct me. Because I, you know, you wear so many hats, and I go from focusing on this one area, and then I'm all of a sudden I'm really, really focused on getting this surgery done, and I may forget about the hygiene checks, and all of a sudden that could throw them behind. And so I want somebody to help say, hey, doc, no, don't sit down right now. Go get these checks done first, then get in here where we can do a start to stop finish. instead of a start-stop yep. procedure.
One of my assistants has started doing that, and what she does is she just hands me a list, and at the start of it, it just has the numbers of the rooms. And when we get backed up, it just says like 18742, and 2's my surgery. And those are the numbers, because I don't wear headsets, but everybody else wears a headset. And 1 is the first hygiene I got to check, 8's the second, 7's the third, and then the 4 is the quick post-op I got to check, and 2's the surgery. And that's really helped me, because it's just like, here's the list, here we go. And that's been helpful.
But I do think there's a lot of value in helping to assign specific accountability in the practice. I think, like I said, those people, once they understand that, everybody wants some direction, and the people that have that natural leadership ability will rise to the top for that, and actually they'll volunteer for some, you know, for some roles that you, if you talk about it with your team, and if you let it be known, and again, the more direction that you can give, the better off I've found that the team responds, and it's a work in progress. I'm not perfect at it, but I really have worked hard in the last several years to really focus more on that. You know, don't get so busy that you forget those key aspects, because, you know, the long-term success, you can talk about, you know, turnover, but turnover is expensive from a business standpoint. You know, it really is to train somebody up, and you may have somebody that didn't have a lot of qualifications or skills that's replaced with somebody who's been trained in some of these new skills, and so they have that added value right away. But at the end of the day, you know, dentistry is a relationship business. Our patients trust us. You build that trust. And so, you know, it's a fine line in my book to, you know, you want to have some of that trust, some of that tenure. But also you want people that are willing to learn and grow. And that's one of our key things at our practice. Like, we're constantly going to be growing in trying to get better and better and better at what we do.
Yeah, that's actually when one of my employees left, is when I told them that.
Yeah.
That my expectation was for them to grow. Yeah. And one of the hygienists, they'd been there for 15 years, and that's when she put in her 2 weeks, is when I told her that she was going to go back and learn how to numb, and that was it. So I think you...
I love it.
I think you...
No chance. I'm here to clean teeth.
Yeah.
So on that note, I guess this is the cynical side of me, but... I look back now at my transition into our practice and buying in and taking a lot of ownership. And I hear you, Will, and I hear you, Ford, and I talk to other people. And let me use a unique analogy I think a lot of us can relate to. When you have and Tennessee football can really be a statement to this, because we've been through like 6 coaches in the past 4 years. But when you have turnover and a new coach comes in, what tends to happen to the rest of the staff? Typically, it turns over. Typically, and they may keep 1 or 2 people for a certain amount of time, but inevitably what tends to happen is they tend to get their quote-unquote, and you look in the NFL, it happens even with players. You know, you bring a new coach in and it's not their guy. It's not, and they're not on their vision, their goals, the way they're doing things. And so, you know, the more I kind of look back and see things, and now I look at, you know, as I kind of start to help look at young doctors' practices and try to help them analyze things, I realize that a realistic struggle is it possible to come into a practice that's had tenured team members like we've talked about that can come around, and how long do we let them come around? And do, you know, because at the end of the day, the reality is, I don't know if it's really, and Will, you're shaking your head. I don't think you would kind of agree with me here. Yeah. But it's
it takes
hard.
A special type of person to listen to one doctor for 30 years. And you know what? Let me make an analogy here, because this is about me. I do a lot of CrossFit. So let me go ahead and put that out there. Right, I'm a CrossFitting vegan.
Oh yeah,
just kidding.
Hashtag keto.
Yeah, right. But I do CrossFit, and I've been following my coaches and listening to them for a long time. And what I've realized is that with some of the new coaches, they're trying to get new coaches in there so they can spend some more time off. And those coaches are people that have been in my class before, and they're my friends. And I went to the first few classes with them as my coach, and it was hard to listen. How unfair is that? That I immediately judged their ability to coach me because I already knew them. And because they weren't the boss of me when I first got there. And I thought to myself,
this is exactly how my team feels. And so I felt, you know, I don't think it's easy. I think it takes a special type of person, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're a bad person or that they've got something significantly wrong with them that they won't listen to the new guy. It's just, that's human nature, man.
It obviously is, because you wouldn't fundamentally have every sports franchise, whether it's NBA, NHL, NFL, whatever it is, that has that kind of issue.
Right. I mean, what type of special person does it take to say, I've done the same thing for 20 years with your dad, but you know what? Whatever you want to do, I'm right behind you no matter what. Those people exist. It's just hard to find.
Because for me, I look at our practice, and in some regard, you know, there are some that are coming as close as they came to full circle, but until we have somewhat of an entirely new
tenure, it's just
people,
not.
It will be held back by some degree of something.
Some degree. I truly believe that. Now, you only have one person that was there since you started.
No,
right?
We have three still.
There's three still. So I have two now. And they've come around.
Hopefully they'll listen to podcasts.
All right. Well, they are so much nicer now that the other people have left. I mean, it is night and day. It was like the rotten apple's gone. If you rotten apple are gone, sure. And they know that they're kind of like, well, the other people have left, and Will's totally fine. So I think Will would be fine if I left too.
I think I've seen that too.
They're on their 30th.
There's
years.
A little more of the fear of they've had a little more fear in them now.
Right. Right. So. They're actually doing a whole lot better, and I'm very thankful for that. But truly, you know, you sit down and you start talking to the team about what you want, and there's people that look you in the eye like you're the next best thing to dentistry, and are so excited about the future. And then other people that have been there for 20 years that are kind of like checking their nail polish you know,
rolling their eyes in the back,
right, and peeling the orange, and you're just kind of like, you know, you're telling me you're listening, but your body language is telling me otherwise, and. It's just hard to do something with one boss for 20 years and then expect the same with the new guy.
Ford, give me your thoughts on this, and then we're going to kind of wrap up this episode just from a link standpoint, and then we'll probably start another one. Your thoughts on the idea of is it possible or realistic to come into a practice and maintain that team for a long period of time, or is it inevitably you're going to have to get your people in there?
Well, I was able to do it for several years and, you know, and add and grow team members to it. So, yes, you can. I think it's tough. I think the aspect of the generation, you know, it's hard. You know,
yeah, generations.
If there's a 25-year-old right now that comes up to me and starts telling me, you know, hey, this is what you need to be doing for your practice, my first instinct is going to be, hey, whoa.
Defensive,
whoa,
yeah.
Hold up, right? But, again, it's all in the way that you present it. I think that if you take the time to communicate well, have your team meetings, and really let them understand what your vision is and why it's that way, right? It's not all about the dollar. It's about, you know, whatever you're passionate about. If it's laser dentistry, then it's about I do lasers because I really believe that that's the best quality of care that I can provide for my patients. You know, the implants, I'm changing people's lives because I'm giving them, restoring their function and their smile back. You know, sleep apnea, I mean, my gosh, you know, I'm literally saving people's lives, right? And so when they know that you're passionate about that and that it's really about something bigger than just, you know, fixing a tooth, right, or dentistry per se, it's about being able to really make a positive impact on your patients. If they can buy into that and if that's what you truly believe, that can supersede some of that, hey, this guy, the young guy's in here, I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to give him the time of day because, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years and I know what I'm doing and I do it my way and my patients love me and they don't want me to change. You know, so that sometimes you can break through that way. It's not easy, I'll tell you, but, you know.
Dadgummit, Ford, you make us look bad.
No, I'm not. I'm just telling you. Telling you from my experience, man.
No, but I think you're spot on though, because I think I you know, if I look back and I say my personality now probably could have maintained more team members than we did initially. But the problem was my personality at the time was not able to do that. And Will, to some degree,
tell me how your personality has changed in the last 2 years.
It hasn't changed that much, but my point is my ultimately what at the core, and correct me if I'm wrong for it, but at the core of what you're saying is that fundamentally, I can express the reasoning and the value and why I want to do what I want to do to them more than likely they can start to come around to that idea.
I believe so. It's
And I think I agree with you.
And again, it's when you're genuine, if you're not BSing, man, they're going to be able to understand that and see that. And then they're going to say, okay, my guard's going to come down, right? Because this person really has best interest at heart. If you're just coming in and it's just a show, smoking guns, people will see through that. But I believe human nature, you know, is people are good, you know, at the end of the day, and they want what's best. I believe the majority of people that are in our profession are in it for the right reasons. But sometimes we all become complacent, you know, with the way that we do things. And so sometimes it's just they need a little motivation, a little pushing, a little bit of goal setting, a little bit of, hey, you know, we're going to continue to focus positively and learn new things so that we can constantly bring the best to our patients. And when you have that type of communication, you'll be surprised. People will start to come around. So, I mean, early on, like I said, I've been doing it, you know, 10 years on my own now, and you live and you learn. And
Ford, what city do you practice in?
What's that?
What city do you practice in?
Dixon, Tennessee.
Dixon.
Yeah. So it's, you know, 25 miles west of Nashville. You know, and that's the beauty of it, you know, is surrounding yourselves with good people where you can continue to learn. You talk about these things, and that's how you get better and better and continue to really, you know, grow as an individual and as a professional. So,
perfect. Well, gentlemen, this has been a great episode. We're knocking up against about an hour. Try not to keep under an hour.
If T-Bone watches this, can you tell him that we got his pop-up thing stuck in the
trash?
Like, it won't come off. So it says Raleigh Dental Arts and it has his face on it. And I literally can't get it off. I was like pulling on it.
Nope,
so should I leave
here.
It?
I think you leave it. Let people know.
Is that bad?
All right, everybody. Work smarter, not harder. We'll see you next time. And thanks for tuning in to the Millennial Dentist Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.